There's a lawn chair, and I sit down, wrapping everything about me. Outside, it's still warm and muggy, and flying insects are swarming around the motel parking lot lights. The lot is nearly deserted. It's just about 2 a.m., and the other two members of my squad are delayed due to flight problems. Typical hurry up and wait. I shift and tug the sheet and blanket closer. Army planning. Still hard to believe I'm now Army, through and through. For years, I was with the NYPD, climbing the ladder, making good collars, going from precinct to precinct, and putting in my time in the reserves. I was just out of high school when the towers came down, and after graduating from the academy, I felt I could do a bit of payback while still wearing the shield if luck came my way. But luck and payback came to somebody else first on a dirt road in Afghanistan. A place that still haunts me, but where I will never return. The drone of an approaching car jolts me back to my present assignment. I think of Colonel Phillips, still not liking the depth of his cough during my last talk with him. Nearly a year ago, he called me into his office at Quantico and said, "I'm setting up a special squad. You're going to lead it. It's going to have CID investigators, a JAG lawyer, and a psychiatrist. Your job is going to take on major crimes here and abroad, make sure justice gets done, that there are no cover-ups, and most of all, that the locals don't frame our folks." And I said, "Yes, sir," and now I'm in Georgia. In 1864, General William T. Sherman made his march from Atlanta to Savannah, and just before Christmas Day, he sent a message to President Lincoln. "I beg to present you as a Christmas gift the city of Savannah, with 150 heavy guns and plenty of ammunition, also about 25,000 bales of cotton." Up there in Quantico, my Colonel Phillips is waiting for a gift, and I know it cannot wait until Christmas, or even until next week. A car pulls into the lot and parks near me. The headlights switch off, two doors open up, and the men inside get out and approach me. "Major Cook," the first one says. "It's Lieutenant John Huang, U.S. Army Medical Corps, psychiatrist." "Sir," the second one says. "Special Agent Manuel Sanchez, U.S. Army CID, former LAPD officer." I say, "Glad to see you, gents." I swivel in my chair and add, "You're in room 9, it's unlocked. Two sets of room keys on the bureau. Agent York and Captain Pierce are in room 8. We'll be getting up at 0600 later this morning. We'll check the service records for the four Rangers and prep the rest of our day. Get organized and try to get some sleep." Both say, "Yes, sir," and they get their gear and head to their room. I sit and wait, the parking lot quiet again, and the bugs continue surging around the bright lights. More sounds of cars approaching. At this hour? I think about our meeting with the county sheriff and how she described the last murder in this county, years back, when the abused Millie Porter took her vengeance against her Barry. A common secret among us cops is that most murders get cleared in just a day or so. They're easy, they're blatant, drug deal turns bad, husband or wife gets tired of abuse, and armed robbery goes south. Two cars and a rental van pull into the lot, come to a stop. Doors fly open, there are loud conversations, and I see two men go to the rear of the van, haul out television equipment. The members of the Fourth Estate have rolled in, ready to pass sentence and convict with a few chosen words or 60 seconds of videotape, always able to duck out with that blessed word, alleged. Not me. I'm old-fashioned, I know, but I still want to see where the evidence leads us. I get up from the chair, blanket and sheets still over me, wanting to get back to my room before one of the reporters decides to see who this odd man is. Once inside, I plan to stay awake. As for Sheriff Williams and myself, we don't have a crime to solve, but a mystery. And I hate mysteries. Chapter 10. In his cell at the Ralston Town Jail, Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson is awake, sitting up against the concrete wall, legs stretched out, listening to one of his squad mates snore. It sounds like Specialist Ruiz, originally from El Paso and a good man to have at your side in a foxhole. Ruiz is a great shot and a great scrounger on post, and he has the amazing ability to fall asleep at any place or time, whether in a cold, ice-crusted trench high up in the mountains, or in an FOB shelter with mortar rounds dropping in. A groan and Corporal Barnes seems to come awake. He whispers, "Ah, crap, not again, Ruiz. Hey, Ruiz, knock it off." The snoring increases and Barnes kicks the barred door to his cell, making it rattle. "Ruiz, wake up! Or roll over, Christ!" Jefferson keeps an eye on the situation. The jail here consists of 6 cells, built back when black and white television was still the rage. Old-fashioned bars and locks, concrete beds with thin foam mattresses, single wool blankets, foam pillows with a case thin enough to see through, stainless steel commodes and sinks. His orange uniform is starched, smelling of detergent. "Sergeant, you awake over there?" Barnes asks.
"I am."
Another voice comes out of the darkness.
"Me too. Jesus, when Ruiz starts sawing wood."
The 4th and youngest member of his squad, Specialist Vinnie Tyler, is from Idaho. Skinny, but by God can that kid hump the gear when need be, especially climbing those rock escarpments that seem to rise click after click right up into the clouds. A cough and a hack. Ruiz, originally from personnel recovery, snorts and wakes up. His cell is across the corridor from the other 3.
"Hey, what's going on?" he says. "What did I miss?"
Barnes says, "Nothing much. Miss Sullivan County trotted through here in a see-through nighty, handing out coffee and donuts." Ruiz yawns loudly.
"Fine by me. I hate donuts."
Jefferson smiles as there's low laughter from his men, and he thinks,
"Hey, cops out there surveilling us with hidden cameras, try to figure that mood out."
It's a good fire team, handpicked by him, one of the best, roughest, and finest in the company. He knows their strengths, their weaknesses, and most important, right now, their family status. None are married, none have kids, and that's a good thing not to have in the back of one's mind when chasing the Taliban through ravines, or facing serious trouble stateside. Save for him. His wife died 2 years back from ovarian cancer, and her daughter, his stepdaughter, Carol, is under the care of an aunt in Savannah and is mending at a treatment center in Hilton Head. His team is lean and mean, just the way he wants it. Tyler calls out,
"Staff Sergeant Jefferson?"
"Right here," he says.
Everything's gonna be fine, right? You're sure, right?"
Jefferson thinks of that old house with the filth inside and the yells and shouts, and he knows Tyler is scared. It's one thing to fly hot into an LZ or to take fire from a tree line or to make a dynamic entry into some rock and dirt farmhouse over there in Afghanistan. But this is here. This is CONUS. This is the blessed safety zone.
"Everything is going to be fine," he says. "Don't you worry none."
Ruiz says,
"Hey, specialist."
Tyler says,
"Yeah, Ruiz, what is it?"
Ruiz swears in Spanish,
"You second guess the sergeant one more time, the first chance I get, I break your freaking nose."
Chapter 11. Special Agent Manuel Sanchez is sitting next to Special Agent Connie York as she drives the rental Ford sedan down a bumpy dirt road, and Manuel is holding onto the door handle, trying very hard not to upchuck his morning breakfast of greasy sausage, eggs over easy, and grits. Grits. He has yet to figure out the attraction of grits, just a fancy name for mush, and beans for breakfast? Not here, not in this place. At the entrance to this dirt road was a wrought iron metal pole pockmarked with rust, and dangling to the side was a very worn wooden sign with painted carved letters saying The Summer House, 1911. In the rear of the sedan, Major Cook, sitting so his injured left leg is stretched out, says,
"Connie, can you slow it down?"
"Sir, we're running up against the clock. I think we're almost..." "Yep, there it is."
Manuel knows what Connie means about the clock because he's been here in Georgia less than 6 hours, and after the rushed briefing before breakfast, he already feels like he and the rest of the squad are a day behind. 4 Rangers in jail, 7 civvies dead, including a 2-year-old baby girl, and pretty soon reporters will be dogging their every step. Connie breaks the Ford to a halt and dust rises. Then they all get out, Major Cook struggling for a few seconds with his cane. Connie and he pretend not to notice, though he enjoys noticing Connie. In the morning heat, she's discarded her black jacket and the slacks are pretty tight around her curvy bottom, and the white blouse is clinging nicely to her torso. But Manuel knows better than to look too much at his fellow special agent because he's still deeply in love with his wife, Conchita, back home in East LA with their three girls, a sweet little home in a relatively quiet neighborhood. Besides, Connie is wearing her Army-issue Sig Sauer in a waist holster and is a better shot than he is. As he and Connie wait for the major to join them, Manuel examines the old two-story house. At one time, it was probably a destination to be proud of, a place to unwind from the city. Two wooden pillars at the front, black roof and black shutters, wide wooden door in the center. But the paint is faded, shingles are missing from the roof, and the pillars are cracked and sagging. There's yellow and black crime scene tape fluttering across the door, along with an official sheriff's department adhesive seal pressed against the door jamb. Two pickup trucks are parked nearby, along with a Sentra whose trunk is being held closed by a length of frayed clothesline. A light blue Volvo sedan with a Delta Airlines parking sticker on the windshield is set some meters away, like the driver was concerned the rundown vehicles here would somehow infect it. In every direction except the dirt road they just came down, there's nothing save brush and tall pine trees, though through the brush at the far end of the lot there looks to be a body of water. Manuel frowns. Too much emptiness, too many trees. He grew up in a crowded LA neighborhood, joined the police academy, and went over to the Army when the police department was shedding personnel to balance its budget. Plus, the Army at the time was promising a hefty enlistment bonus.
Looks damn empty and quiet, Major, he says.
True, Cook says. Connie? She glances down the dirt road.
Odd, only one real entry in and out. You come in for a hit, and you leave yourself open for trouble if a UPS truck or some lost soul comes down the road. It could block you, get people curious why you're here.
In the distance, a dog barks.
Let's take a look around, Cook says, and he leads the way, leaning heavily on his cane. Manuel and Connie follow. It doesn't take long. The perimeter is trashy with discarded tires, rusty 55-gallon drums, piles of lumber and chicken coop wire, and sodden pizza boxes. Manuel wonders if the ghosts of the rich folks who built this place mourn the once perfect yard. On the far side of the house, one of the windows is open, and from another window, a rusting air conditioning unit is sagging on supporting 2x4s, looking like it could fall at any moment. One and then two helicopters roar overhead. The other two windows on that side are closed, and so are the ground floor windows on both sides. One of the windows is covered with plastic. After returning to the front, Manuel says,
I don't like that single door, Major.
Tell us why.
He says, like the dirt road, only one way in or out. With a dynamic entry rolling in, you'd think they'd use a ladder, smash one of the first floor windows, come in through both the door and the windows.
Cook says, this is Georgia. Lots of firearms and private hands. Maybe they thought rolling in through the windows exposed them more. That door looks like it was breached by explosive charges. You do that, folks in tight quarters like this, in a small house like this, they might run to the rear when the door blows open. That means you're funneling your targets into one area.
Maybe, Connie says, and Manuel knows she's looking at the scene with the same cop eyes he is, though her earlier time was with the Virginia State Police, not as difficult or as tough as the LAPD. I wish the sheriff hadn't been such a bitch. I'd love to go inside.
Manuel turns at the sound of a loud car engine, getting louder and roaring down the dirt road is a brown and white Sullivan County Sheriff's Department cruiser, bouncing up and down in the dust. And Cook says, well, let's see what happens if we talk nice to the sheriff. The cruiser skids to a halt, and Manuel sees a woman in her 50s jump out, face red with anger, wearing jeans and a black polo shirt, and she yells out,
damn it, Major! I told you I wasn't going to let you into the goddamn crime scene! What the hell do you think you're doing here?
Cook looks pretty damn calm, and he says, you told us we couldn't go inside. We're not. We're outside, looking in.
The sheriff strides forward, fists on her hips.
You like to play games, Major, is that it? Well, tell you what, I got some friends in D.C. and I can play games too. Including getting your whole goddamn crew out of my county and back on the first plane to Dulles.
Chapter 12. Lieutenant John Huang of the U.S. Army Medical Corps gets out of the rented Ford sedan, pulled into a narrow parking space in front of the Ralston Police Department. On the small front lawn, memorials listing Ralston's war dead from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, and all the way up to Vietnam, share space with poster board campaign signs for various offices. Captain Alan Pierce joins him on the cracked pavement. It's not even 8 a.m., and the shade of the large oak in the park across the street is not large enough to protect them from what is going to be one hell of a hot day. Down a ways is a Southern Baptist church, and exuberant singing is coming from the building. John shakes his head. Twice in the past 5 years, he's gone to overcrowded Hong Kong for extended family reunions and thinks the residents there would smile in delight at seeing so much empty and available space.
What do you think, Alan?
He asks. Officially, Alan outranks him as a captain, but since Alan's a lawyer and he's a psychiatrist, they decided months ago they could drop the ranks and the yes sir and no sir while working in the field. Think? Alan asks, reaching into the car, retrieving his briefcase. Like him, Alan is wearing a two-piece dark blue suit with black shoes and a white shirt, no necktie.
I think you and I have just increased this town's diversity by 20%. Come on, Doc, let's see if someone's awake at the jail.
There is a single dark blue Ralston police cruiser parked in the lot, along with a red Dodge Colt stained with rust and mud. A narrow concrete path takes them to the rear of the brick two-story building, where Ralston Police Department is painted in gold on a glass door. John tries the door. It's locked.
I like the look of that, Alan says, coming up next to him, reading aloud the paper sheet directing emergency, after hours, and weekend contact to the Sullivan County Sheriff's Department. Small town, small crime.
Except for the four Rangers stuck in there, charged with slaughtering 7 civilians, John says, still not wanting to believe on an emotional level that Rangers could do something so horrid in the States,
but also knowing from cold clinical experience that anything is possible, including the slaughter of civilians.
There's a doorbell, John says. Give it a push.
Alan pushes it twice, and before his third try, a shadow appears behind the door. The door is unlocked and pushed open, and a plump young man wearing black-rimmed glasses, gray trousers, and a blue uniform shirt with no name tag or shield says,
"Yeah, you guys lost or something?"
He has keys in one hand and a coffee mug in the other, bright red with yellow letters saying Official Bikini Inspector. John thinks,
"Yeah, lost in time, about 5 decades.
And Alan says, "I'm Captain Alan Pierce, United States Army, and this is Lieutenant John Huang. We're here to see the four Rangers." The door is being held open by the man's hip, and he takes a sip from his coffee mug before saying,
"You guys have an appointment?"
John says,
"No, we don't."
"You've spoken to Chief Kane about coming here?"
Alan says, "No, we haven't. We got in late last night." The man says,
"You got badges or something?"
John takes out his leather badge case from an inside coat pocket, shows it to the jail attendant, and Alan does the same. The jail attendant rubs his chin with the hand holding his keys and says,
"Well, I guess the chief needs to okay this, but he's not here."
Alan smiles, but John sees how his fellow investigator is nearly gritting his teeth.
"So where is he? Can you call him?"
The young man looks surprised, like both he and Alan should know what's going on.
"Fellas, it's deer hunting season for muzzle loaders. The chief is out by Sweeney's track by now, and there ain't no cell phone coverage out there."
Alan's smile is getting icier, and John says,
"Sir, if I may, we're not here to cause any trouble. We're here to help those four men. Now, we know they've been charged with horrible crimes. We understand that. But the captain here is an army lawyer, and I'm an army doctor. And we've been ordered to see the men, to talk to them, to send a report back to Washington."
John knows what he said is 50% true, 50% bullshit, but he hopes the magic words of army, orders, and Washington just might work. The jail attendant says,
"You're here to help, then?"
Alan says.
Sir, absolutely. John has a guilty thought that this is probably one of the few times this pudgy young man has ever been called sir. He says, "You stay here, I'll be right back." With coffee cup still in hand, he steps back in, locks the door, and then disappears from sight. Alan says, "Looks like it worked."
"Yeah."
"Tell me again, how do you do it?" Alan asks.
"Me, I've got law books and online records to help me puzzle out legal crap, years of precedence, and judges out there to kick me in the nuts if I stray too far. But you?"
Alan taps the side of his head.
"All between your ears, Doc, trying to figure out what's going on with some other guy's brain. Don't know how you do it."
"There are degrees in learning on our end, too," John says, feeling uncomfortable in the heat.
"Yeah, but I know enough about psychiatry to know that every 10 or so years, there's a big upheaval that turns everything upside down. Lawyers? Man, we're still working off a document that King John signed more than 1,000 years back. How do you do it?"
Like a PowerPoint presentation, faces of past patients he talked to after joining the army come to him. Men and women, young and old, privates to colonels, all sizes and shapes and colors. But one thing is the same for each of them. Their eyes. Each has the same dull, blank look of someone who has gone into the abyss and is trying so desperately to climb out. And he, Dr. John Hwang of Stanford and the U.S. Army Medical Corps, is lying along the lip of a precipice, reaching a hand out, anxious to rescue his patient down there in the darkness, and also desperately hoping that, listening to the bloody horrors they took part in and witnessed, he won't also be pulled down. John says,
"I don't know. It's a gift, I guess."
The shadow reappears. The door is unlocked, and this time it's opened only a foot or so. The jail attendant stands in the gap, nervous, face pale, no longer holding the kitschy coffee cup.
"Sorry, fellas. None of them wants to see you," he says. "You need to leave. Now."
Chapter 13.
I wait for Sheriff Williams to take a breath and I step forward, keeping my voice soft and low. "I'm sorry you feel that way, Sheriff, and with all due respect, I'm not here to play games."
"You got one funny goddamn way of showing it," she says, nearly spitting out the words.
I say, "Sheriff, you have to admit you placed us in a box. You told me we couldn't get access to the crime scene. I respect that. If I didn't, then I would have had Special Agent Sanchez." I gesture to him, standing about 3 meters away, "knock that door down and let us in. I didn't do that."
The sheriff folds her arms.
"A goddamn good thing you didn't, or you and yours would be getting processed right now in my county jail."
I smile, nod, trying to maintain a reassuring look. "I respect that and appreciate that, Sheriff. Now, if I may, we're all here. It's still early on a Sunday morning. You've been active duty, you've been exposed to enemy fire and danger in Iraq. Not many people can say that now, can they? And you know that out in the field you have to bend sometimes to get your job done."
Sheriff Williams lifts an eyebrow.
"Like me bending to let you into the crime scene?"
"Sheriff, my detachment and I are here on official business. We need to get into that house, and I'm just asking you, from one army vet to another, to allow us in." I wait. Then a slight smile appears on her previously hard face, and she lets her arms fall free.
"You're a slippery and smart one, I'll give you that. All right, we go in, but no photos, nothing taken from the house. You follow my lead."
"Absolutely." She nods to me.
"And don't forget, Major, I'm a slippery and smart one, too."
I follow her to the wide wooden steps leading to the door of the old home, and she removes the yellow and black police tape and gently drapes it on a railing. Up at the door, she turns and says,
"Years and years ago, this was a famous place in our little town. It belonged to a rich fella named Callaghan, owned a shipping company over in Savannah. There's a little lake nearby, and he and his family and rich friends loved coming here during the summer before air conditioning came here."
She shakes her head.
"Yeah, a nice little historical place. Poets, writers, politicians, they all made their way here, including FDR, like I said earlier. And then the Callaghan family got hit hard during the Great Depression, had to give it up and other properties, and from generation to generation it came to this.
being rented to a bunch of losers by some property management company. Okay, let me give you a bit of a timeline before we go in.
Behind me, Connie and Manuel have notebooks and pencils in hand, both starting to scribble. She says,
"This past Thursday, Whitey Claymer, a friend of one of the deceased and a student at Savannah Technical College, came by for what he said was a random visit at about 7 a.m.
Right.
At that hour of the day?
Based on what we found in the house, he was probably coming for a drug buy. Nobody answered his knocks. The door was partially open. He went in, saw what he saw, came out and puked, and then called dispatch. First unit responded, saw the extent of the crime scene, and I was next, along with everybody else in the force, including retirees."
She squats and points to the hinges, where I note familiar-looking scorch marks and bent metal.
"One of the first things I spotted. Look, the Rangers used det cord or some other explosive device to get in. Very quick, very pro."
She stands up and takes a folding knife from her pocket, opens it up and cuts through the seal blocking the entry.
"Give me a hand, will you?"
She drags the door to one side and I do the best I can with one hand, the other one holding onto my cane, and I think, good job, Sheriff, putting me in my place and showing us who's still in charge. William says,
"You can bet how much the shit hit the fan when we saw what was in here. My investigators got right to work and we started canvassing the area."
I ask, "Did you call for help from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation?" She scoffs.
"The GBI? The vampires? Nope, no thank you."
Connie says, "Why do you call them vampires?"
The sheriff turns to Connie and Manuel.
"Legend has it, vampires can only come into your house if you give them permission. Same with the GBI. State law says they can only come in to work with local law enforcement if you let them in. Believe me, not many sheriffs in Georgia want that. Not going to happen in my county. Okay, let's take a look, see."
We cluster just beyond the entrance. My eyes adjust to the dim light. The first thing I see is an overturned couch. There are yellow and orange triangular evidence markers on the scuffed and worn wooden floor, now stained with blood. Without notes, which I admire, William starts reciting the facts of the crime scene, pointing to different areas in the room.
"This is where we found the first three victims," she says. "Gordon Tilly, Randall Gleason, and Sally Tisdale. This TV here was still on when their friends stopped by Thursday morning, paused on some kind of shoot'em video game. Ironic, huh?"
"Yes," I say. "Very ironic." We go farther into the home and I spot more of the plastic triangles on the floor. The counter in the kitchen area has fingerprint dust residue, and the same is on the wooden walls leading to the stairs going up to the second story. William says,
"We recovered from the residence 2 9mm pistols, a shotgun, and a .308 caliber hunting rifle, along with scales, plastic bags, and about 20 pounds of marijuana. And before you ask, the pistols had not been recently fired."
Manuel says, "Were these people known to you?" The sheriff shrugs.
"Some, but from what I heard from my sources and others, they were strictly small time, not on my top 10. Upstairs?"
To me, the wide stairs look as daunting as the first time I saw a climbing rope, dangling in a gym when I was in 7th grade at PS19. "You go first," I say. "I don't want to hold you up." 6 minutes later, I'm at the top of the stairs, with Williams, Connie, and Manuel all pointedly looking away from me as I feel how warm my face is, the trickle of sweat down my neck and back, and the burning and screaming coming from my insulted left leg. Fingerprint dust is on the door frames to both bedrooms. "Thanks," I say to no one in particular. "Sheriff?" She takes an audible breath.
"Worst scene is in here."
"Then let's get it over with." We cluster at the entrance to the bedroom while the sheriff goes in, points to a group of evidence triangles on the floor and stains on the floor and against the cracked plaster wall.
"Gina Zachary," she says. "She was found here, shot in the back of the head. Looks like she was trying to protect her little girl. And well, that's her bloodstain over there."
It's small and cramped in this bedroom. The smell's deeper and fouler. I'm breathing through my mouth.
The bed, she says,
not bothering to point. Blood spatter is on the wall where the mattress butts up against it.
Stuart Pike, shot dead here in bed. His name's on the lease.
Manuel speaks up. He was in bed?
Yes, the sheriff says.
Okay,
Manuel says after a moment. The sheriff says,
something wrong?
No, Manuel says.
Seems funny, that's all. Downstairs, the door gets blown open. They're shooting, running up here. The Rangers are chasing up after them, and he's still in bed.
I keep quiet, and so does Connie. William shrugs.
Maybe he was drunk or doped up.
She glances at her watch.
One more, right across the way.
We go into the other bedroom, which has two beds. The air is only slightly better in here. Williams points to blood spatter on the floor.
Last victim, Lillian Zachary, older sister of Gina. Looks like she was hiding under the bed when she was dragged out and shot.
I look at Manuel and Connie, and they're just taking in the scene. A few seconds pass.
Sheriff, anything else you can tell us? I ask.
She rubs at her chin, checks her watch again.
We got two witnesses who put your boys on the scene or heading to the scene. Lady up the way was walking her dog Wednesday night, heard some shouts and gunfire. There's a utility light at the end of the driveway. She saw a pickup truck come down the driveway, hauling ass. It stopped and she saw the driver and a passenger. She got a partial plate number because she was spooked by all the noise. We managed to trace it to a Ford F-150 Super Crew registered to Sergeant Jefferson, and she ID'd him and another ranger from a photo lineup we were able to later pull together. After we put out a bolo for him, a Ralston police cruiser spotted the Ford at the Ralston Pub and Grub Friday night, and all four were inside, getting drunk.
All right, I said. And the other witness?
There's a gas and go about a mile down the road. Owner of the store remembered two of your rangers coming into the store, kind of wired up. They were dressed in regular army camo gear, not civilian clothing. Two other fellas were out in the parking lot, smoking. Then they got into the F-150 and headed out, going in the direction of this place. Timestamp says they were at the store about 20 minutes before the lady walking her dog heard the shooting.
Manuel and Connie maintain their composure, but I can sense what they're feeling. This is not looking good for the four rangers. I say, that's very thorough, thank you, Sheriff. One more look at her watch.
I'll tell you two other things before I get going. One is that we dusted the area and found prints belonging to two of your rangers, Staff Sergeant Jefferson and Corporal Barnes, and we recovered shell casings and their...
A chiming sound cuts through the thick air, and the sheriff digs a cell phone out of her rear pocket, slides a finger across the screen, and brings it up to her face.
Sheriff Williams, she says.
I can make out the murmur of someone talking to her, and she nods and says,
okay, okay, thanks, Bobby, for pushing this one through. Appreciate it. You take care. Best to Mary and the kids.
Her face looks worn as she puts the phone back into her pocket.
That was Bobby Pruitt over at the GBI's forensics lab in Savannah. We seized Sergeant Jefferson's 9mm Beretta pistol when he was arrested Friday night, and Bobby did me a favor, put the pistol right on top of the test list.
I thought the GBI were vampires. The sheriff says,
not when they're staying put in Savannah and helping me out with a solid.
I think we all know what's coming next, which doesn't make it sound any better.
Sorry, Major, she says. The shell casings we found here are a match to Sergeant Jefferson's sidearm. The truth is, your rangers were in this house that night and killed all these people, including that little girl.
Chapter 14. At Hunter Army Airfield, just south of Savannah, Special Agent Connie York parks their Ford rental in front of a three-story brick building, headquarters for the 4th Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, and home to the four Rangers who are in a town jail in Ralston, nearly an hour away. The water tower for the post is visible nearby, and while most of the facility is open land with palmetto trees and southern oaks draped with Spanish moss, the ranger complex is a post within a post, with high brick walls enclosing it, complete with wire and spikes on top to discourage any unofficial visitors. Next to her, Major Cook stays silent. He's been quiet on the drive over here after that horrid search of the kill house, although he was quick and pleasant during their earlier meeting on post with Colonel Brenda Tringali, head of the 3rd MP group of the CID. She gave them additional information about the four Rangers, the usual and typical complaints of them being drunk and disorderly while off duty, though the initial complaints were never followed up because local law enforcement agencies didn't want to get the Rangers into trouble. When they left her office, Connie said to Cook, "She seemed fairly cooperative, Major." And he said, "Of course she was cooperative. This case is white hot and is going to cause one hell of a mess for the 4th Battalion here and everybody else on post. Better we outsiders take the heat than her and her MPs." Connie switches off the car engine. Cook remains quiet, holding his cane in his hands. "What are you thinking about, sir?" she asks. There have been times when she's felt comfortable enough to banter and joke with him, but not this time.
"I'm thinking about what Sanchez asked back at the murder house,"
Connie says. "About the civilian, Stuart Pike? The one found dead in his bed?"
"That's right," Cook says. "Sanchez made a good point. Why was he still in bed?"
"Maybe the sheriff is right," she says. "Maybe he was drugged, drunk, or passed out."
"Passed out enough so he doesn't at least get off the bed when his girlfriend runs screaming into the bedroom after the front door gets blasted open?"
Cook replies, opening the door.
"Come along, we've got work to do."
An hour later, she and Major Cook are still waiting outside the office of Lieutenant Colonel Vincent Marcello, commanding officer of the 4th Battalion. They are in a small outer office, sitting on a black leather couch. While at his desk, an apologetic Major Frank Moore keeps on making excuses for his commanding officer. Moore says,
"I'm sure he'll be free in just a few minutes, Major. I'm so sorry for the wait."
Cook says, "No apologies necessary."
But Connie knows exactly what's going on. She and Major Cook are just army cops dressed in civilian clothes, and the commanding officer here is putting the two of them in their place. All around them on the walls are photos of the Rangers with the 4th Battalion, in action in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as earlier deployments to Panama and Grenada. Several helicopters thrum overhead, and not for the first time as a CID agent, Connie thinks of herself as a fraud. She's a tough cop, a good investigator, but she's not a real soldier. She knows that. She and Sanchez are both warrant officers, an odd and mostly overlooked rank between an NCO and an officer, and even though they're supposed equals, Sanchez always likes to rag on her that he's got more field experience with the LAPD and 6 months more in the CID than she has. This airfield and those photos and the men and women out there in this hot Georgia heat, they're the real army. The records of the four Rangers they all examined this morning were certainly eye-opening, with the listings of their duty stations, schools attended, and deployments conducted. The records also displayed what the four accused Rangers overall have achieved: combat infantry, pathfinder, parachutist, and air assault badges, ribbons denoting the Purple Heart and the Bronze Star Medal, plus various other recognitions. At the time, Connie felt embarrassed. She's known as a slick sleeve, her uniform bare of service medals and overseas campaign ribbons. Waiting now for Lieutenant Colonel Marcello, that feeling comes back, of being an imposter among these real soldiers. Major Moore is wearing camouflage fatigues and his ink-black hair is closely trimmed. He says, "I still can't believe you're here and that Sergeant Jefferson and his fire team were arrested. It must be some kind of mistake." After seeing and hearing all the evidence this Sunday morning, Connie doesn't want to burst the Major's bubble, but Cook says, "That's what we're hoping too. Tell me, do you know them well?" Moore shakes his head. "They're an Alpha Company. I never interacted much with them, but man, the stories about them. They're called the Ninja Squad."
"Really?" Cook asks. "Why is that?"
Moore says, "They're superb at moving at night. I mean, everyone can move at night. With NVGs on, it's hard not to. But Sergeant Jefferson and his crew, they take it a step further. It's like they're goddamn shadows or something.
And Sergeant Jefferson, he's tight with his men. All teams are tight, but Jefferson, his men trust him and follow him. No questions asked. Once I heard how he weeds out newbies who want to be in his section. They go on a night hike through some deep woods, and Jefferson marches right off a cliff into a swamp. Fall isn't much, but for Sergeant Jefferson, those who fall with him into the swamp with no hesitation, no questions, they get in. The others don't.
Connie says, sounds impressive. For training. Moore shakes his head.
Same thing out on deployments. His fire team always gets the tough jobs because they can get them done, no bullshit. He and his team can approach a target farmhouse, even with dogs and Taliban guards around, and they can still slip into a compound without anyone noticing, breach the door, and kill everyone before someone can pick up a weapon.
Shit, Connie thinks. Doesn't that sound familiar? And Moore says, thing is, when they get stateside, wow, can they get into...
When his phone buzzes, Moore gives the two of them a big smile. He picks up the receiver and says, Moore. And after a few nods, he says, yes, sir, straight away. He hangs up the phone. The Lieutenant Colonel will see you now. Lieutenant Colonel Vincent Marcello is standing behind his desk, an impressive piece of furniture that Connie thinks is bigger than her bed back at Quantico. The desk is brightly clean, and Marcello continues to stand as he looks down upon a piece of paper. There are the typical in-and-out baskets, two telephones, and a computer monitor. It's a corner office filled with light and souvenirs, plaques, and photos are up on the wall. Marcello is huge, bulky, like under his camo uniform there are slabs of muscle, and he's bald, the only hair being two bushy black eyebrows. Without lifting his head, he says, Major Cook, why are you here? After half a beat, Cook says, Colonel Marcello, my team and I were ordered here to conduct an investigation into...
I know that, Major.
He cuts in, voice louder, head still bowed down.
But I have a very competent investigator here, Colonel Tringali of the 3rd MP Group. I trust her and her CID investigators. She even has a positive working relationship with Sheriff Williams over there in Sullivan County, the scene of the crime. So why are you here?
Orders, sir. Marcello finally lifts his head. There's a pink scar running down his right cheek. Connie is suddenly glad that her boss is the focus of the colonel's anger and attention.
A special squad for a special case?
You could say that, sir. We investigate those matters of high priority and high attention to make sure the accused's rights are preserved, but also to ensure that justice is done.
Sir. Marcello stares at her boss.
In other words, you bigfoot right in and take over the investigation.
Not entirely accurate, sir.
If you say so.
Marcello picks up a pen, signs the document before him.
Well, you're here. You have questions, I'm sure. Ask away.
Sir, we'd like to interview fellow members of their platoon to see if...
Not going to happen.
From Connie's vantage point, it seems like Cook is really leaning on his cane. The pain in his left leg must be awful this afternoon with all the walking and standing.
Sir? Cook asks.
Oh, didn't I make myself clear? You cannot and will not interview members of that team's platoon.
May I ask why, sir?
Certainly,
Marcello says, opening his center drawer and carefully putting his pen inside, then closing the drawer.
Because we are this nation's firefighters, ready to go anywhere when the president tells us to go. We're trained and equipped to deploy to anywhere in the world within 18 hours, and in approximately...
He glances at a large watch on his large wrist.
2 hours, Alpha Company is boarding C-17s to go overseas. And those men don't have time to talk to you. Nor do I, for you see, Major Cook, I'm leaving with them to join them in Bravo and Charlie companies.
Connie is growing angrier and angrier with each passing second, hating how the Lieutenant Colonel is completely ignoring her. Cook says,
with your deployment, sir, who will be assigned as rear detachment commander?
A long second or two passes, Marcello says,
not bad for a former NYPD cop. The rear detachment commander will be Captain Rory O'Connell. He has a few months left before his ETS, so he'll be handling personnel issues and other routine matters for the battalion.
I'd like to arrange to interview him, sir, Cook says.
You don't need my permission, Major, but he'll be a busy man dealing with the battalion's affairs.
Another glance at his watch.
You have time for one more question, Major. Make it a good one.
Cook says,
Sir, these four men under your command, they are in serious trouble, having been arrested in connection with the violent deaths of seven civilians. At some point in our investigation, would you consider being a character witness for them?
Connie is surprised at how quickly and violently Marcello delivers his one-sentence answer.
Not on your life.
Cook says, Sir, if I may.
Why is that?
Marcello looks at his watch one more time.
In the field, there is no squad that I'd rather have at my back than Sergeant Jefferson's. But we're not always in the field. Since they've been CONUS, they've been a constant pain to me. Some years ago, Major, a predecessor to my battalion command, saw his career ruined because his Rangers acted wild on post and off. That's not going to happen to me. As far as I'm concerned, the quicker those four are convicted and sent off to prison, the better.
Cook says,
I see, sir. Glad you do,
the colonel says.
Chapter 15. Even with his rental car's air conditioning, Special Agent Manuel Sanchez has sweated through his suit coat, shirt, and trousers. And his miserable day out in rural Georgia is not even close to being over. Following the tour of the summer house, now forever to be known in their official paperwork as the Murder House, Major Cook and Special Agent York headed off to Hunter Army Airfield. Lieutenant Huang and Captain Pierce were sent to the nearby town of Ralston to interview the four jailed Rangers. Cook said to Sanchez,
The sheriff said a woman witness was out walking her dog the night of the killings. That means she's around here. Go find her and talk to her.
But as Sanchez quickly learned, around here is a pretty wide swath of mostly empty land. The nearest two dirt roads off the main road led to nothing but dead-end turnarounds sprinkled with empty beer cans, broken cardboard boxes, and plenty of shot-up targets and broken bottles. The third dirt lane led to an empty house. The fourth dirt driveway ended at a worn and sagging gray house where a heavy-set, tattooed, bearded man wearing cut-off jean shorts and rubber boots up to his knees and no shirt came out onto the leaning porch with an old couch taking up most of it, eyed Sanchez as he identified himself, and then said,
You're not one of those Jehovah's Witness types, are you?
No, sir, he said. Like I said, I'm a special agent in the U.S. Army conducting an investigation.
About what?
The people who were murdered up the road at the place called the Summer House.
The man scratched at his hairy belly and said,
Don't know nothing about that. But if you do see any witnesses in your travels, tell them not to bother knocking on my door. My soul ain't worth saving.
Now he's at a third house, going down a short but wide dirt driveway that has a campaign sign at its entrance, Re-elect Sheriff Williams. And when he gets out of the silver Ford sedan, he hears a dog barking from inside the single-story ranch-style home, with yellow clapboards, black shutters, and peeling paint. A good sign. He walks up to the wide front porch, taking everything in. There's a parked Volkswagen Beetle, a new model, though rusted and battered some, and a sagging clothesline and an old washer-dryer combo dumped to the side. He takes a step up onto the porch, the dog barking even louder, and knocks on the door. The porch has two chairs whose upholstery is torn, letting some stuffing dangle out. There's a water bowl on the wooden planks, and the door leading into the house has deep gouges, like a dog is used to scratching it, begging to come inside. He knocks twice more before a woman cautiously opens the door.
Yes? She asks.
The woman is in her late 40s or early 50s, face worn and tired, her gray-black hair pulled back in a ponytail. She's wearing a floral house coat that she's grasping around her neck, and she's keeping the screen door closed. Ma'am, sorry to bother you, but I'm Special Agent Manuel Sanchez of the U.S. Army. Her tired eyes widen.
The Army? For real?
Yes, ma'am, he says. Here's my badge and identification.
He holds his leather wallet up to the screen, and the woman gives it a quick glance and says in a voice that's almost a hoarse whisper,
What's the Army doing around here?
I'm part of a team investigating the murders of seven civilians who lived up the road at the summer house, he says. Four Army personnel have been arrested.
The woman looks uneasy and Sanchez says,
I've talked to Sheriff Williams about her investigation. She said a woman walking her dog saw a Ford pickup truck leave the house right after the shootings. It was you, correct?
He waits. Behind the woman, the barking dog is louder and louder. Sanchez wonders if he should press her when she says,
"That's right."
Finally, he thinks, and he opens the screen door and gently presses himself into the house. I promise this will only take a few minutes. Inside the house, a large dog that looks to be a brown mongrel with large, floppy ears leaps up and nearly knocks Sanchez on his ass. He backpedals as the woman says,
"Toby, Toby, you knock that off right now."
A large smear of dog drool hits Sanchez's pants leg as the dog barrels past him and bursts through the open front doors, howling and barking in apparent joy after breaking free. She closes both doors and says,
"That Toby, he sure has a spirit about him. When he wants to run, he runs. When he don't want to come in, he don't come in."
Sanchez quickly takes in the house. Before him and to the left is a kitchen area, and to the right is a small living room. Behind him is a small coat rack with a light jacket, a raincoat, and an umbrella hanging from pegs. There's another water bowl and a half-filled dog bowl below the coat rack. He's still looking around when he says,
"Ma'am, I'm sorry, I don't recall your name." "Oh," she says, Wendy Gabriel, would you like to sit down?"
The interior of the house is relatively cool after spending the last couple of hours traipsing outside in the hot Georgia sun, but Sanchez isn't sure how to reply. The interior of the house is so crowded and cluttered that he can't believe it's still standing. There are piles of newspapers, magazines, stuffed cardboard boxes, folded up clothes, more newspapers and more magazines and mail, hundreds of pieces it looks like. A hollowed out area in the living room reveals a worn couch and a television set, and a nightstand piled with bags of dog treats and candy. A hoarder, he thinks, but he gives the woman credit. She's a neat hoarder. Everything seems to be in its place, though there are lots of places.
"This way," she says,
and they go into the kitchen where there's a lonely, uncluttered chair. Wendy picks up thick piles of Newsweek magazines. The top one has a photo of Ronald Reagan on the cover, and he sits down.
"Thank you, ma'am. I promise I won't stay long."
She sits down, too, hands still holding the house coat closed.
"Those killings. Horrible, simply horrible. My God. Is the army going to arrest them, too?"
"The crimes were committed off post, ma'am, so it's under civilian police authority," he says, taking out a small notebook and pencil. "But the army still wants to know what happened, the how and the why."
She says,
"But how come you're not in uniform?"
Which is approximately the 900th time Sanchez has been asked this, and he says,
"I'm with the army's criminal investigation division. We usually wear civilian clothes because it helps us blend in while we're doing our job. Now, if I may,"
he flips open to a blank page in the notebook and says,
"Sheriff Williams told me that you witnessed a Ford F-150 pickup truck leaving the residence sometime Wednesday night. Do you recall what time it was?"
She says, "Oh, yes, without a doubt. A bit after 8 p.m., right after Jeopardy was over, I was taking Toby for a walk."
"Along the main road then, right?"
"That's right," she says.
"And what did you see?"
She shifts in her chair.
"We were heading home. We were on the side of the road where the dirt path leads into that place where the college kids were staying. The one everyone calls the summer house. Is it true they was all shot? And a baby girl too?"
He nods.
"True, I'm sorry to say. What did you hear or see?"
Wendy wipes at her eyes.
"So sad, so very, very sad. Well, it wasn't sad then, it was just strange, that's all. I was with Toby and I heard a loud bang, like a truck was backfiring. Then a bit of gunfire, not loud, but like they were shooting from the bottom of a well. Now I know what regular shooting sounds like, but maybe it sounded different because it was inside, not outside, you know what I mean?"
"That I do," he says. "And did you hear anything else?"
"Well, before the shooting happened, a helicopter flew over. And after the shooting stopped, we walked another minute or two, and just by that dirt road, this Ford pickup is driving real fast and nearly runs me and Toby down.
They stopped for just a second, and then they sped off, went north.
Did you see who was driving?
This real angry-looking black man, and there was another fella sitting next to him. They both looked at me, and Christ, I was scared. I don't know why, but the way they looked at me, they frightened me some.
Had you ever seen those men before?
Nope.
Sanchez is taking notes, mind dancing along, knowing that when this case comes to trial, she's going to be one hell of a witness for the county.
Ma'am, Sheriff Williams says you remembered the license plate of the truck, is that right?
That's right.
Well, excuse me for saying this, but did you write it down?
Nope.
Had you seen the truck before in the area?
Nope.
Then,
the first smile of his visit appears.
You're asking me how I remember what I saw? Easy. I like doing them puzzle books, you know, filling the blanks and the crossword puzzles. Letters and numbers, they stick with me. I remember the first three letters and the first number, afraid I didn't catch the rest.
And what was that?
The letters TBB followed by the numeral 3. The sheriff later told me when she thanked me for being a witness and picking those photos of those two fellas, she said she was able to trace down the letters and number and match it to that angry black guy driving the truck.
But the letters and the numeral 3? Why did you remember that?
Easy, she says. T for Toby, and B because I call him Baby all the time, and the number 3, that's how old he is, Toby Baby 3.
Sanchez writes that down as Toby Baby remains outside, howling and running. Ma'am, when did you learn about the murders?
When Deputy Coulson, when he came by the next day, asking me if I saw anything in the area the night before. I told him and gave him the license plate letters and number, and a few hours later, I was at the county building talking to the sheriff.
There you go, Sanchez thinks, and he says,
Ma'am, is there anything else you can tell me? Anything else at all?
She shakes her head, the smile fading, still looking tired and discarded.
No, I can't think of anything.
Sanchez takes out his business card, passes it over. Ma'am, thanks so much for your help. I greatly appreciate it. This card has the number for my cell phone in my office. You think of anything, anything at all, call me at any time. He gets up and the woman looks at both sides of the card and says,
Is there a reward?
Sanchez says, If I find out there's one, you'll be the first to know. He gives the place one good last glance, from the piles of dirty dishes in the sink to the endless piles of mail and other junk, to the two coats and umbrella hanging from the coat rack to the water bowl and bowl of food. There are also three doggy chew toys, neatly lined up, two covered plastic bins neatly filled with dry dog food, a shelf that holds a grooming brush and small boxes of dog vitamins and pills. Wendy opens the door, leading the way out, and yells,
Toby, Toby baby, come back home now, you come.
He goes to his car, gives the woman a pleasant wave, gets into the car and starts up the engine, letting the cold air just wash over him. Sanchez makes a turn and then heads away from the woman's home, wondering why Wendy Gabriel lied to him. Chapter 16. Captain Alan Pierce is lost, a feeling he hates, and he turns around once more in the town of Sullivan, looking for the district attorney's office. Twice he is parked at the county courthouse, which also holds the sheriff's department and is next to the county jail. And both times the doors were locked, even though an earlier phone call to the district attorney said he would be waiting for Alan in his office. What the hell is going on here? Are the locals making fun of the army outsiders and laughing while seeing them go around in circles? There's been a group of residents sitting on benches across the way at a park that proudly boasts a Confederate Army soldier statue, and Alan is feeling that's exactly what's going on. He looks at his iPhone, checks the address for District Attorney Cornelius Slate, sees the address, and the numbers don't match. On the wooden sign near the parking lot is the number 44, noting the street address for the county buildings. Slate's address is listed as 62 Sullivan Highway, also known as Route 119. Not in the county buildings, after all. He pulls out of the parking lot. Fool, he thinks. Overreacting. and lost to boot. 15 minutes later, Alan's in a renovated light yellow Victorian house where Cornelius Slate shares space with a dentist's office. The heavy-set, cheerful man parters around his crowded office, offering him coffee from a Keurig machine, talking about the weather, and inquiring about Alan's travels. On a hardwood floor covered with dusty oriental rugs sit bookshelves and filing cabinets, and framed black-and-white photos of what looks to be downtown Sullivan hang on the wall. Slate is in his 60s, paunchy, wearing dark green trousers with suspenders and a striped shirt, sleeves rolled up his beefy forearms. His head is fleshy, white hair combed back in a pompadour, and his black-rimmed reading glasses are perched halfway down his nose. "Sorry I'm late," Alan says for the third time since arriving.
"Ah, don't worry about it," Slate replies, making a dismissive wave of his hand. "Not all district attorneys in Georgia are high-paid employees of the county, hanging out in fancy courthouses. You get out of one of those urban counties like Chatham, where Savannah is, it gets rural real quick. There's not enough crime around here to maintain a full-time district attorney, so I have my own practice and step up to the plate when need be. Which is an honor, but can also cut down on some of my billable hours, not able to defend a client because of the conflict of interest."
"Have you been district attorney that long?" he asks.
10 years and 2 more, God willing, if the good folks here in Sullivan County decide to return me to office.
Alan holds the warm cup in his hands. "I've seen the campaign signs. For you, the sheriff, the congressman, others."
"It's that time of year," he says. "Tell me, young fella, you seem a smart sort. Where did you go to school? How did you end up in the army?" "I went to Columbia," Alan says.
"One of my professors, he had been a first responder on 9/11 before going to law school. He died young of cancer, probably from working at the towers after they came down."
Slate nods. "Revenge, then."
Alan corrects him. "Justice.
And have you always practiced law here?"
The district attorney grins.
"Sure looks like it, the messy office I got, the town where I live. Nope, I went to George Mason and then worked corporate law for Georgia Pacific for lots of years. Ended up with a fat paycheck and sleepless nights. Quit Georgia Pacific. Now I have a small paycheck and I sleep like the proverbial baby."
Then he shakes his head and says,
"Well, what a mess, eh? All those murders, those 4 Rangers arrested. And at the summer house at that. What a goddamn shame to see a lovely place like that get run down and dirty, and have all those folks get shot inside. A real damn shame."
Slate leans back in his old-style office chair, which loudly creaks.
"I can see why the Army sent a fellow like you down here, but what's your job, to defend them?"
"No," Alan says, sipping the coffee, which is one of the vanilla-blended spice types he despises. "I'm part of an investigative unit assigned to high-profile crimes like this. We're looking to gather information, ensure that all the facts are known."
"I see," Slate says, his hands folded over his belly. "You also had a Chinaman with you this morning over at the Ralston jail. Where is he now?"
Alan has never served overseas in either Iraq or Afghanistan, but he's sure the hair rising on the back of his neck is coming from knowing he and the others are under constant surveillance. "He's on other duties," Alan says, still hating the coffee, wanting to correct this small-town, small-minded lawyer about using an ethnic slur to describe a fellow officer, but right now he needs information.
"Well, what can I do for you? What do you need to know?"
"I don't know much about Georgia criminal law, so I'm looking for a quick guide," Alan says. "I know it's early, but do you anticipate indicting the 4 of them for first-degree murder or second-degree murder?"
Slate has a cheery smile on his face. "Neither."
"Excuse me?" Alan asks, feeling warm, like the older man is enjoying putting him in his place.
"I guess you do need some guidance after all," Slate says. "In Georgia, we don't have first-degree or second-degree murder. We have malice murder, felony murder, and voluntary manslaughter, among others. Of course, it all depends on the grand jury meeting after the official arraignment for your Rangers."
"When do you expect the arraignment?"
"Thursday or Friday of next week. Grand jury will take a bit longer."
On my flight down, I read that most Georgia counties have grand juries that meet every Wednesday, true? Slate shakes his head.
Haven't you figured out yet we're not a usual county? In Sullivan County, we meet every 6 months for a grand jury.
Alan is stunned. A half-year wait for an indictment? For real? He asks.
Do I look like I'm joking, son? Slate asks.
Nope. 6 months is typical, though I imagine with a case like this one, we'll be able to rearrange things, move it up some.
In the meantime, those four fellows will have an opportunity to have a bond hearing to see if they can be released prior to the indictment, which I doubt. But any way you look at it, these fellows won't be going to trial for a year to 18 months. We're a busy state down here.
I see, Alan says.
Slate says, those four rangers, they sure didn't want to talk to you this morning.
That's their right, he says. Since they were arrested outside their post, they'll have to arrange for their own civilian defense.
But would you advise them if they asked?
Not me personally, Alan says. But I'm sure someone in JAG could lend assistance, but JAG lawyers are trained to deal with the military justice system, not the civilian system.
Sounds complicated, Slate says.
It can be, Alan says.
Slate is still smiling, and then, like a flash of lightning illuminating a night landscape, the smile disappears and Slate frowns, his eyes narrowing and darkening, his fingers clasping tighter across his stomach.
But know this and know this well, and tell your boss, son, whoever the hell he or she might be,
Slate says, his voice low and steady.
Sheriff Emma Williams is one tough and smart investigator. A real bitch on wheels. If she's arrested those four rangers so quick after all those boys and girls and that baby was killed, then she's got a solid case that she's going to give to me when the time is right.
Alan stares quietly at the old man. The district attorney says,
so, son, I'm going to tell you this. It might take a year, 18 months, or even 2 years, but I'm going to find those rangers guilty. And I'm going to make sure they end up on death row and someday get a needle in their veins. You got that?
I got that, Alan says.
Good.
The smile returns and Slate moves his chair forward.
Anything else?
Alan stands up, reaches over, puts his barely touched coffee cup on the district attorney's desk. Just one more thing, Alan says. I'm a commissioned officer in the United States Army and an attorney admitted to the New York and Virginia bar. Unless you spent some time wandering around Long Island 30 or so years ago and had a brief affair with my mother, don't call me son ever again. He turns and quickly walks out.
Chapter 17. Lieutenant John Huang is sitting on a park bench across the street from the Ralston Police Department, just waiting. It's been several hours since he and Alan Pierce visited the police department's jail and were turned away, and when Alan said he was going to visit the district attorney, John said he would stay behind.
And do what? Alan asked.
Talk to the Rangers.
How?
And John said, by using my wily Asian ways. How else?
The day has been long, sitting here in the shade, reading articles on his iPhone from back issues of Journal of Psychiatric Practice, and once going into the nearby small convenience store to grab lunch. The young lady wearing jeans and a blue smock with Addie on her name tag took his money and passed over a wrapped ham and cheese sandwich and a bottle of Lipton iced tea. Then she said,
mind if I ask you a question?
Go ahead, he said, knowing what was coming next.
What are you?
She asked.
Huh? Do you mind? Japanese? Korean? What are you?
He scooped up his lunch and change and said, Californian. Now he waits.
Earlier, and separated by 30 or so minutes, two different sets of dark blue Ford vans pulled up across the street.